Testing. Testing.
The first thing is probably to get your own family history, what you know of your own ancestors. I'd like to ask everybody that I talk to, you know, what they know of where your father and your mother were born and as far back as you can go. Where were your father and mother
born? My father was born at Lima, Ohio. And his family goes back. His father, his grandfather, at least, were raised at Lima. And I can trace the Miller family back to Virginia as far as 1735, I believe.
Was that one of the first settlements of the German Baptists?
In Virginia?
Yeah.
Yeah, the German Baptists first came to eastern Pennsylvania, and after the Revolutionary War, then moved down into Virginia, where they found greater protection and freedom, because they had some problems during the colonial days and the post-revolution days. And I feel that they left Pennsylvania because they suffered some persecution there, and that's why they went down into Virginia. And there was large migration then after the Revolutionary War into the Northwest Territory. And Jacob Miller, we're not sure if he came from Virginia, from Europe himself, or if his father came from Europe. But he was born in 1748. And his ancestry has been traced back by Carson Miller in the 1930s, and a pretty complete genealogy that I've been able to obtain, and most of the work's been done. And then I did a genealogy on my grandfather's family, and I'm in the process of bringing that up to date now, too.
What was your grandfather's name?
My grandfather's name was Christian Miller.
Christian Miller? And your grandmother, what was she?
On my mother's, on my...
well, your paternal...
My paternal grandmother. Her name was Emmeline Mishler. And the Mishlers I have trouble tracing, but I've developed quite a genealogy on them. And I can't trace them. I'm sure they came from Pennsylvania to northeastern Ohio, Stark County and Summit County. And then in about 1840, or shortly before, moved to Miami County and northern Montgomery County. And my great-grandfather, Adam Mishler, was born probably in southern Miami County in 1840. And then moved to Indiana, Kosciuszko County. And then my grandmother, Emmeline Mishler, was born there. And married my grandfather in Lima, Ohio.
And then, do you know about your maternal grandparents?
Yes.
Your mother's name?
My mother was a Balls Ball, B-A-L-S-B-A-U-G-H. And she came from Miami County, Indiana. Uh-huh. And her Balls Ball ancestors from Dauphin County, Pennsylvania. And the Balls came probably from Switzerland, where their name was spelled something like Falzbach, and changed to Balls when it came here. And her mother was a Bollinger, and the Bollinger family we can trace, and I have a genealogy here. We can trace that back into the late 1600s to a Rudolf Bollinger. That came from Canton Bern in Switzerland.
Well, your Swiss ancestors then, were they weren't German Baptists? Were
they? They were probably Swiss Baptists or Swiss Brethren. And I think that the Swiss Brethren really antedate the German Baptist Brethren.
Oh, really? I didn't realize
yes.
that.
The Anabaptists, or those who rebaptized or baptized again, came from northern Italy and in Switzerland. And they were the predecessors of the Mennonites and the Moravians, and the German Baptist brethren were rather latecomers then, but probably had Swiss brethren ancestry.
I didn't realize that. I thought they were pretty... Well, I knew that the German Baptist started in one town. I can't pronounce it.
Schwarzenau.
Schwarzenau. Yeah.
And Wittgenstein, Germany. But I think that they didn't just originate out of nowhere.
Yeah.
There was a Anabaptist movement can be traced way back in to in much earlier times. And the Waldensians were the people that lived in the hill country of northern Italy and Switzerland and southern France, and they were in a way Protestant people. They were not Roman Catholic. And while we can't trace any direct lineage, I don't believe, I think that through groups like these that lived in the hill countries, you can trace the ancestry of the movement. The Anabaptists were an unorganized group of people that came not to believe in infant baptism, and therefore they believed in believer baptism, baptism of believers, and therefore they had to rebaptize, or they were Anabaptists, and in Germany called Wiedertaufer, or baptized again. And then the Protestant Lutheran Protestant Reformation came along in the 1500s, and among the Lutheran Protestants there were also a group which were called Pietists, and the Pietists were people that believed that religion should be from the heart and not a formal type of religion. They believed that Christianity was a matter of piety. And so I think that the German Baptists probably were, while they were Anabaptists, were greatly influenced by the Pietists. And these Pietists were the Swiss brethren and the Polish brethren and different groups which simply called themselves brethren throughout the hill countries of that area. And out of these came groups such as the Mennonites. They originated in the early 1500s. They were Pietists. And the Moravians. And
the Amish.
Amish were a split with the Mennonites, who felt that the Mennonites had gotten away from their more strict discipline, especially of the use of the ban in banning someone that was unfaithful in the church. And they followed a man by the name of Jakob Hamann. And then there were also certain particular men that preceded the brethren and had a great deal of influence on them, such as Gottfried Arnold and Hochmann, was a Pietist, and a man by the name of Felbinger, who was, there's not much known about him, but he did some writing, and he was of the Polish brethren. And these men then influenced Alexander Mack and a small group at Schwarzenau. And Mack's father owned a mill at Schwarzenau, and Mack was, that's where he grew up, and with a group there organized a group of brethren, which were just called brethren at first, and later on became known as German Baptist Brethren.
Do you know if any of your own relatives are or were Mennonite or Moravian, or were they all pretty much of the German Baptist Brethren?
As far as I know, and as back as far as I can tell, they were German Baptist Brethren.
Uh-huh.
The Bollingers were probably German Baptist brethren maybe before they came to America. And the Balsbaughs probably were German Baptist brethren. The Millers were German Baptist as long as they were in America, and we don't know about before that. The Mischlers were German Baptist as far back as probably 1800 is about as far as I can trace them. And there were others in my ancestry. And if you want some of the names, I probably have them right here.
Oh, okay.
I don't find it right now. Bullries, Cripes, Culps, Fishers.
Well, during the two big schisms in the church in America, the one in 1881, when that all split up, do you know of where your ancestors went? Whether they all decided to be the old order or the Church of the Brethren?
Well, that's not very far back. And my paternal grandfather was born, I think, in 1869. And he and his father were with the old orders. My paternal great-grandfather Adam Mischler was with the old orders. On my mother's side, Albert Balsbaugh was my grandfather, and he was with the old orders. My mother's side, the Bollingers, most of that family went with the Church of the Brethren, but grandmother and grandpa stayed with the old order group.
Was that in 1881, there was a split into three groups?
Yes. The split was in 1881 when the old orders pulled off from the main body, and in 1882 when the so-called Progressive Brethren, or now it's called the First Brethren Church, split off.
And the other one was called the Church of the
Brethren. And it's called now the Church of the Brethren.
Well, when the old orders pulled off from the Church of the Brethren, was there any particular thing, one thing that they were protesting against, or was it a general feeling of
there were a few specific things that they mentioned, but I think the main general thing was that the church in general was getting away from what they called the old ways. They were no longer holding to what they felt to be important. As far as maintaining the church as an entity, for such things as baptism and communion, I don't think that there was any. There was difference in opinion as to how this should be carried out, but nobody was trying to drop baptism or anything like that. There were some things that had gotten into the church which they felt would lead away from a life of simplicity, and it would be detrimental to trying to live a life devoted to God. There were some things that had gotten into the church which they felt were not supported by the Bible, and the movement was more or less a back to the fundamental Bible teachings movement. One thing was that the church had started Sunday schools, and the old order said that Sunday schools are nowhere mentioned in the Bible. They're a creation of man in the late 1700s. And that they have no place in church worship. There were some in the church that wanted to establish church high schools and did establish church high schools and church. It was going to lead to church colleges. And the old orders saw a trend here. They felt that, well, the brethren had always felt that the ministry should be a voluntary ministry. It not necessarily unpaid. The ministers could be reimbursed, but they were not to be salaried ministers. The brethren always believed in a plural ministry. They had 2, 4, 5 ministers in a congregation, and their ministers were selected out of the congregation, and they weren't seminary-trained men. And they felt that the unsalaried, plural ministry was the right way. They felt that if a minister was taught in a seminary, then he would depend upon his teaching and not upon what God was to speak to him. And they felt that if he was a salaried minister, then he would preach what the people wanted to hear, or else he would lose his job. And he wouldn't be free to preach what the Spirit gave him to say. And they saw, and I think that it turned out that they were right, that church-established schools led to seminary-educated ministry and a salaried ministry and a solo ministry. And they felt that this was not good for the church. They felt that the church should call out speakers from among themselves who were to speak as they were led by the Spirit. And what was said then would be Spirit-inspired rather than seminary taught. So, church schools, Sunday schools, the brethren felt that conversion was for people who were drawn by the Spirit to accept Christ. And they felt that any emotionalism was wrong. And the brethren were starting to use protracted meetings in which a minister would go and preach, and he would preach for every night for a week or so and have an altar call, and by emotions would try to get people into the church, and then would publish how many converts he would have from a evangelistic meeting. And they felt that conversion should be the leading of the Spirit, and Christianity should be the expression from the heart, and that frequently conversions under emotion are not lasting. And so protracted meetings, as they called them, was one of the issues. And then the church was getting away from simplicity of dress and simplicity in their life. And they felt that a uniformity, or at least a modesty of dress, was very important. The prayer covering had always been used by the brethren, and some of the sisters was getting away from prayer covering and using wearing hats and wearing more stylish clothing, and this was something that they were opposed to.
Do you know when that happened? Were your was your grandfather, grandparents, were they here Miami County yet?
No. My grandfather Miller was at Lima, and my grandfather, great-grandfather Mishler was in Indiana, and my mother's family is all in Indiana.
When did your paternal grandparents come here?
To Miami County, Ohio? Yeah. Well, I'm just a newcomer here myself. My father moved from Lima, Allen County, to Montgomery County in 1945, and then And I was about 8 years old, so the rest of my life I grew up there, and I've just lived here about the last 8 years.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that. So actually you grew up in Montgomery?
Yes.
Which is down by Dayton.
Next county south, right. Yes.
Right. Was your father a farmer?
He was a farmer until we moved to Montgomery County, and then he was a carpenter.
Uh-huh. The other big schism in the church, which was in 1921? Is that? Well,
yes.
I say big schism. I
you
know
mentioned the other division in 1882.
Oh, right. The,
and
the
those are progressive brethren. They felt that things were still too slow, and they wanted to see a lot more changes. And then the trends since then are very interesting, and maybe this isn't the place to go into them, but it's an interesting study to see where the Church of the Brethren have gone since 1882 and the Progressive Brethren since 1882. That's because I believe that the Church of the Brethren have become much more progressive, and the Progressive Brethren much more conservative, and there's been a crossover there.
Well, now, when they split off, when they wanted things more progressive, what specifically did they want that they felt the church didn't have?
Education and publication were big things at that time, I think.
And at this time, now, I know the Church of the Brethren is very liberal.
Yes.
As far as dress or occupation.
Education.
Pretty much a Protestant, kind of Baptist, general Baptist church.
Yes, and a social doctrine, I think. Very, very much outreach to the community and into the world and in their outreach.
And the first brethren are the ones that were progressive?
They were progressive, yes.
And now they're probably a little bit more
conservative. And they're smaller, but I think the ones that I have known tend to be somewhat conservative. That's probably too much of a generalization.
Do they adopt the traditional dress?
No.
No. Is there a church first brethren in the area?
Yes, there's several of them.
Covington or Pleasantville?
Yes, and they had a division later on, I think in the 20s or maybe 30s, in which the Grace Brethren split off. And I don't know that much about them, but as some of the Grace Brethren I've known, while they don't have a uniform dress, they tend to, some of them tend to emphasize modest dress at least.
Then in 1921, which was another split, that was when the petitioners?
Yes. That's what they have been called. They're called the Old Order German Baptist Brethren. And the names, I think, are legal terms. Our official name is the Old German Baptist Brethren.
Oh.
And they call themselves the Old Order German Baptist Brethren.
Oh, see, I had that confused because I thought that your church was the Old Order German Baptist Church.
No.
And it's just the Old German Baptist Brethren.
Yes, I think these names a lot of times have been adopted more or less for legal reasons. There have been times ownership of church property and so forth. And it's necessary to have an official name, I guess.
Well, why, how did they get the name petitioners?
Well, our people were called petitioners, too, at one time, because they drew up a petition and took it to the annual meeting, expressing their dissatisfaction. Our brethren did, and then in 1921, the petitioners did the same thing, and this is how they got their name. They had certain things that they were dissatisfied with, and they drew up a petition, which was signed by whoever was sympathetic to that way, and took it to the annual meeting, and since they brought this petition, they were the petitioners.
Now, do you remember that 1921?
No.
No, you probably wouldn't.
I'm not that old.
You're not that old. Did your father? Yes. Did your father ever say, talk about it? Or?
He remembers it and he followed it.
Yeah. Well, how many, approximately, was it a big group of people?
It was a rather small group, and it was a local group. The largest group, I think, was here at Covington. And then other churches here in the Miami Valley, and a few from Indiana, and then a few from maybe Missouri and Kansas. But it was all—it's always been a small group.
How many would you say are in the group now in Covington?
50 or 60, I suppose.
And what was the name?
50 or 60 in the whole group, which is. Mostly isolated just to this area now, Upper Miami Valley.
Was the main division point whether they would use automobiles or not?
That was the main issue, yes. I think after they split off, there were some other issues came up that they wished to define. But the automobile was the main question. They felt that the automobile was an invention that they didn't have any need for. They felt that it would be detrimental to their way of life. And their brethren and our brethren, too, in the past and now, try to avoid anything that might be popular in the world, especially if it's detrimental or not beneficial to us.
Well, now, as it stands now, do you think that's still the main division point between the petitioners and?
No, there are other things now that, as other things have come along, they have had taken a stand. For instance, on electricity, they don't have electricity in their home. They don't have telephones in their home.
Can they use telephones?
They can use other people's telephones if they have a need for it.
Do they have plumbing?
Yes. Yeah. And some of their homes are quite nice, actually. They might have a gasoline engine which will run a washing machine, and they might have a gas-operated refrigerator. And,
they don't consider that to be.
No.
No. Okay. Well, it's interesting just to see where the dividing line is. And, you know, everybody, I guess, has their own opinion about what's, you know, too much and what's not. Now, most of them, are they farmers? Most of them?
No. Some of them work in factories, Hobart's here in Troy. And a couple of them right now, I think, work in hospital.
How do they get to work?
They can usually get a ride with someone
they can
else.
Ride.
Yes.
In automobiles, but they can't own them.
That's right.
Well, do they, as far as clothing goes, they're. Do they dress more conservatively than your order? Or?
Yes, they do.
In what way?
A lot of people that look at them perhaps couldn't tell the difference, but we can usually tell the difference. They're, the men, for instance, wear hats that have broader rims, and perhaps that's the major difference with the men. The women wear coverings that are larger and bonnets that are larger and dresses that are longer, and the cut of their dress is a little different. For instance, our sisters have a cape and an apron on the dress, which is attached to the dress, but theirs is the way the old brethren used to do. They have a cape that pins around the neck and an apron that ties on.
Mm-hmm.
Are there, let me turn this over. As far as, what was I going to say now? Oh, are there very many younger people who have joined the petitioners?
Yes, especially recently. At one time, we thought that they were going to become fewer and fewer. But when I've been there to their worship in the last year or two, they have quite a few young people, girls and boys, and even a few that weren't raised in their group that have joined their group.
I was going to ask if there are very many people who, you know, were not brought up in the tradition but have adopted the tradition when they were exposed.
They're not a large group, but... And I would have to sit down and perhaps count the numbers, but percentage-wise, I think it's a fair percent.
Well, now, as far as the Church of the Brethren goes, in your church, do you think that the division has gotten broader since the time when you first split off?
Yes, the division between us and the Church of the Brethren is so broad now that... they're no threat to us, and we're no threat to them. Most of their young people and older people don't even know that, either don't know that we exist or don't know that there was ever any connection. They're surprised when we tell them that they used to be just like us. And some of the young people, some of the ministers have expressed to me that they didn't know that we existed until they got into seminary and were taught then about their history. And some of their professors of history have said that, and have actually taken their class to one of our love feasts, and have said that you can learn more about Brethren Love Feast by going to the Old Orders Love Feast than I can teach you in the class. And so, as a field trip, so to speak, they will take him to the love feast.
Which is strange, because I guess probably the first time they've been exposed to their early heritage.
Yes. In the seminaries, and I've had some contact with some of their historians and some of their professors, and the ones in the seminaries are aware of their Brethren heritage and are beginning to prize and cultivate their Brethren heritage. But I think only as a heritage and not as a way of life.
Not as a living. Whereas really the old German Baptists are continuing this as a living way of life.
It seems to me that way.
As far as, you don't have Sunday schools.
No.
As far as the education of the young, then that's taken care of at home.
Yes. And the young from infancy up go to church.
I know.
As you know from being there, some people think that the babies are disturbing, but we think that they ought to be there and brought up in the meeting. And it's surprising how young they begin to learn and listen and pick things up. My children surprise me sometimes, and I think that they have to be taught from little up if they're going to appreciate it.
Is there a regular time that you set aside for perhaps reading scriptures or Bible learning, or is that done just whenever?
We try to. That's with the busy life, that's difficult to do. And
yeah.
And we're always admonished and advised to not neglect a home altar and reading and prayer and study at home. There's perhaps something I should say about all these divisions, and some people have found fault with the Brethren and with the Mennonites and with the Amish for so many divisions, but I think that that's more apparent than anything else. If you take one of the popular churches, there's really very little unity of of thought, and everyone can believe and live pretty much the way he would like in some of the churches. In our church, we're advised not to partake in a lot of things, and there are some things that if we do, then we are strongly admonished, or if it's some serious problem that is felt to be a scriptural thing, then we still will set this person away from the sacred meals, and they're not permitted to take part in communion, or they might be placed out of fellowship. And so there's a certain amount of pressure to conform to the order and to the doctrine of the church. And human nature being the way it is, there's going to be disagreements as to what is right and what is wrong, especially if it's not something that is definitely outlined in the scripture. And I think that this is why there have been the divisions we're talking about. But when you look at it, that there was a three-way division in the 1880s, and there's been perhaps two divisions in the old order since, and perhaps a few very minor splinter groups of just a few individuals. There's much more unity among the old orders than there would be, say, among, I'll say, the Church of the Brethren, or almost any other church you might want to mention, in which anyone can do and believe the way they feel and still be in fellowship with that group.
That's one thing that I noticed, is that it seems like a really close-knit group of people. It's a nice feeling that you get of fellowship. You know, at the service, I was noticing that everyone, of course, knows everyone and is interested. And, you know, as far as meeting people, it was really nice to have so many people interested in what I do. You know,
it's easy to get into conversation with our people.
Mm-hmm. Which at first surprised me, because a lot of people would think that because your church does want to stay unworldly, you don't want to have contact with people who aren't in the church. But that, I found that's not the case at all.
A lot of people that see us on the street in our garb and so forth would say that we're very standoffish and hard to learn to know, and have real misconceptions about us, I think. And I've had people ask me if they would be permitted to come to our worship, and are surprised when they're invited to come. And perhaps this is a fault of ours, in that we don't reach out to people in the community like perhaps we could. But on the other hand, I think that a lot of people like you have found that most of the people are friendly and easy to learn to know.
I think when people, anyone who really is interested, would find that out really fairly shortly. You mentioned when we were talking about the divisions, were there any other divisions that I didn't know about that happened perhaps here locally, or?
None that I know of locally. There was a division in 1913, and I think that this was mostly in Indiana and California. These people call themselves the Old Brethren.
It's more confusing.
Yes. Or we call them the Salida Brethren, because most of their group is around Salida, California, in the Central Valley of California. And these people left the fellowship because of the telephone. And the church was accepting a telephone, and they didn't think that it should be accepted.
The petitioner is now here. Can they have tractors?
Yes.
Is there any restriction on... Is it just automobiles that they can't have, or any kind of vehicle?
Automobiles and trucks.
But they can have a tractor because that's essential for the farm?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And was that a fairly new thing that they adopted, or was that always the case when they split off in the 20s?
No, I don't think they had tractors at first, and I don't know when they did start having tractors. It's been fairly recently that they permitted rubber tires on tractors.
Oh, really?
They felt that if one of their brethren had a rubber tires on the tractors, then he might be tempted to drive to town with it and use it for, as a car. And so they had a little trouble in accepting the rubber-tired tractors, but and I suppose it's been 20 years or more since they accepted that, and they do tend to go to town for the groceries and pick up things in town.
On their tractors?
Yes. We can see inconsistencies in them, and I'm sure that they can see as many or more in us, too.
Yeah, but, well, I was behind two carriages this morning. I noticed they have to have a big fluorescent triangle on
yes.
the back to...
Some of them have been hit by cars, and they're sort of sensitive to that, and some of them have generators on their that run off the wheel or batteries in the buggy, and have flasher lights on front and back and turn signals. And
well, I imagine the way that sometimes cars travel down the road.
You can see them a long ways off if they've got flashing lights on them.
Yeah, it's a good thing. Where do they get the carriages? Is there a certain place that makes them?
Yes, there's a buggy factory up in north central Ohio, near north of Millersburg, Ohio. I've attended this buggy factory mostly for the Amish.
Right.
And there's a harness factory joining it, so they can get a buggy there. I think buggies are also made out at Burn, Indiana, where there's a settlement of Amish.
And as far as your clothes go, are they made at home, or is there a place
the buggies? Their buggies don't go out of style. They don't get a new one every 2 or 3 years. They fix up the old one, and they might be used for years.
Yeah.
The clothing, the sisters make, most of the sisters make their own dresses. There are some sisters that will make dresses for others and make coverings for others and bonnets. And my wife makes all her own dresses.
What about the prayer suits? Caps? Are they made at home?
Some sisters make prayer coverings, and Emily doesn't make hers, but a lot of times there's sisters that make those, and that's part of their living. And
mm-hmm.
The men's suits, there are some sisters that make men's suits. And there have always been clothing companies that have made them in Dayton or in Chicago. And right now there are some Chinese tailors that go around and will measure for suits, and they're made in China.
Really?
And in Pennsylvania, for instance, where there are a lot of Mennonites and Amish, you can go into the store in New Holland, Pennsylvania, for instance, and maybe in Lancaster, and buy a suit off the shelf.
Regular, ready-made
suits.
Is there any difference between your clothing and, say, the Amish?
Yes, there's a difference. And there's a difference among the Amish, too. They can tell different groups among the Amish by their dress. Some of them don't wear buttons, they wear hooks and eyes. They're called the Hook and Eye Amish. And a lot of these things have a historical background. And in my book, I mentioned that the original buttons were made out of bone, and they were often made out of human bone. and they were ornamental. And if you go back to the 1400s, 1500s, when the Amish originated, buttons were bad, and some of them are still stuck to the tradition.
What about the hats?
There are different companies make the hats, and you can buy them in different stores in Ohio and Indiana.
You mentioned that the petitioners have a broader brim on their hat.
Yes.
What about, say, the Amish or the Mennonites? Do they?
The Amish do too.
They have a broader brim.
Yes, the Mennonites are quite a variable group of people, and you can get all the way from conservative Mennonites that dress in a plain garb to progressive Mennonites who have no plain dress.
Right. Well, as far as beards go, now you don't have a beard, but most of the men in your church do. It's not a requirement.
It's not a requirement, no. It's never really been a requirement among the brethren. I think the Amish, most of the Amish groups require it, especially after a man marries, he's supposed to let his beard grow, or after he has his first child. This varies with different congregations. Among the brethren, they were always advised to wear the beard, and the beard is considered to be part of the order. But they have always, as they say, they bear with those that don't feel to wear the beard. And many of the younger do not. I think probably there's more brethren wear beard now than have in the past, according to my father. And when he was a young man, he says that there weren't as many brethren wear the beard. The ministers and deacons and elders are more strongly advised to wear the beard as an example of the rest of the church.
Is there a restriction on?
Probably
for you. You said that most of the older brethren do wear the beard.
Most of them, not all of them.
And the Church of the Brethren, of course, doesn't have anything to do with.
Not as a. As a church, rule or church order at all, but as I've been to the seminaries and with some of the professors and some of the Church of the Brethren that are interested in the Brethren heritage, I see have let their beards grow. And I met a young fellow that's a senior in their seminary just 2-3 weeks ago, and he looks as much like an old order as could be with a. A suit just like ours, and a beard, and a hat. It's interesting that his own plain church in Pennsylvania refused him as an intern minister for the summer, because of his plain garb.
Could be prejudice on the other side. For the sisters in the church, is there a certain type of hairstyle that should be worn, or can you wear your hair any way you want as long as it's covered during prayer?
No, the sisters all wear their hair up in a roll in the back, and prayer covering over this.
Is it permitted to cut your hair?
They're supposed to have long hair. I think that some of the sisters, when their hair grows down to way down their backs, when it becomes difficult to manage, I think they probably cut the ends of their hair.
And now, children, before they join the church, there's no restriction on clothing?
There's no church restriction. With clothing becoming, more and more immodest, according to the the fashions now, and very short dresses and slacks and pants and shorts. We hear more and more admonition in our council meetings that the members try to get their daughters especially to wear modest clothing.
Mm-hmm. And what about the children that don't join the church? What are there very many who don't?
This has been a thing of interest to me, and I would like to do a study on it. And some of the other brethren and I have talked about doing a study on what percent of our members were not raised in the church and what percent of our young people leave the fellowship and go somewhere else.
And so you don't know how
I don't know what many. I don't know the percentages.
Is there any if say your child didn't want to join the church when they grew up, then would there be any kind of bad feeling, or would that be normal?
Well, it's frequent, more frequent than we like, and I think that any feelings that there would be feelings of disappointment in seeing your child reject your own way of life and follow some way of life that you could not approve of. I don't think that as long as the children don't get into anything that's really considered an evil, I don't think that they're ostracized by the parents or anything. Noticing families where the young people have left the fellowship, I would say that the parents are disappointed more than anything else.
I think that happens in every church, really. If you're brought up a Catholic, and
surely.
Which
is something I've noticed. If someone from another church comes to our group and joins our group, I see the same disappointment in their parents.
Yeah. Well,
often, not always.
A lot of times, I know in other churches, where the division comes is when the child becomes of marrying age and they fall in love with somebody who's of another church who perhaps wants them to change over to their church, and they do. Does that happen very often in your church where, say, either a child who's been brought up in the Old German Baptist Church wants to marry someone who's not of the church, and they convert or, you know, come into the church, or does that happen very often?
Which way are you speaking about? Are you speaking about if they marry someone outside
both.
The church?
If they marry someone outside the church and they have them come into the church, or if they marry someone outside the church and they leave the church, does that?
It happens either way, of course.
Uh-huh.
I've seen cases in which our young people marry outside the church and join with a church, but frequently they don't. It seems like frequently they'll join with nothing or drift from one place to another. In my view anyway, seem just to be dissatisfied with their way of life. Some of them do seem to be dissatisfied, but even in people in their older years, I've had them express things to me that I think that they've married outside the church and they've gone to church somewhere else or not going to church at all, and have never really been satisfied with their way of life. And I think that maybe they carry a little bit of their raising with them and have never found anything really to measure up to it. Fairly frequently someone will marry someone from outside the church will marry into our church from any other denomination, Catholic, Protestant, or nothing. And this couple will either come to our church or perhaps will not. We'll find some other fellowship. I have seen that a lot of times the members that we have that weren't raised in our fellowship are some of our strongest members. And I think it's partly because they have had to think and study, and they've made a change intelligently and have given enough thought that they're able to defend it, and they make some of the strongest members we've had.
I imagine, since it would be a drastic change to some of them,
sure,
to adopt another way of life.
Although, for instance, someone raised in the Catholic Church, in the past at least, has been raised in a fairly rigid atmosphere frequently with a ritual and with a catechism, and they're taught their catechism and they're taught to respect the leaders in their church, their priest and so forth, and when they come to our church they fit in fairly well because we have a doctrine and an ordinance and an annual meeting which makes decisions which we're expected to follow.
At each annual meeting, are there fairly frequent major decisions made? Differences, say, from the year before that the church makes, or is it...
You mean a change in...
Yeah.
A reversal of previous decisions or something like this? First I should mention that this last weekend was Pentecost weekend, and our annual meeting is always held on Pentecost. And
that is significant, right?
We feel it's significant. We consider Pentecost as being the birthday of the church, when the Holy Spirit was given to the church. And I guess as far back as we have held annual meetings, they have been held on Pentecost, or at that time. You ask about reversals of decisions that the annual meeting has made. I guess I'd have to give that some thought. The automobile question, for instance, there were several years in which the annual meeting said that the members were not to have automobiles. And if you think back, at that time it was a novelty in the teens, with no roads and no maps and no gas stations, and it was a real novelty then, and I can understand why the brethren said that they should not have automobiles. And I guess officially the church has never said that it is all right to have an automobile. In 1920, the annual meeting said that they would bear with members that bought automobiles and advised them to get inexpensive, plain, simple automobiles and use them in a Christian way. And there have been several decisions since then advising members not to get worldly automobiles, expensive automobiles. It's difficult to get an inexpensive one now. Two-tone automobiles and things like this. And the decisions now are advising the members, I think in the same spirit that the church advised the members in the early 1900s, when they said that there are some things that might cause some problems here and that we should proceed with caution. And I think that all these admonitions were admonitions in love and attempting to get the members to consider each other's feelings and to get something that was practical and stay away from sporty models and things like this. Mm-hmm. And if you consider that the decisions of our annual meeting are made in the spirit of love and an admonition to avoid things that might lead away from a simple life devoted to Christ, then I think these decisions have greater meaning.